Hey all, it's your co-host Nick here with Psychedelic Passage, and I want to share what our organization does and how we can help you on your psychedelic healing journey. We originally started Psychedelic Passage to give folks access to psychedelic therapy within the comfort of their own home. And in the process, we realized that most people have no idea what they're looking for in a guide, and they don't know which providers are qualified. The consequences of sitting with an unqualified provider are dire. There are lots of self-proclaimed facilitators out there who simply don't know what they're doing. And unfortunately, facilitator abuse and ethical violations happen regularly in this space and result in lasting psychological impacts. To solve this, we selectively curated a network of providers all over the US who operate with integrity. This allows us to help you as a client by advocating for you and your care without a conflict of interest, screening facilitators on your behalf to ensure they know what they're doing, and holding facilitators accountable for their actions, so you have peace of mind that the provider you're matched with is in good standing. Instead of searching through hundreds of unvetted online provider profiles, you can simply book a call with us, and our concierge team will take into account over 20 different variables to get you matched to a trusted facilitator who can provide treatment in the comfort of your own home. We want to give you the confidence that you're sitting with the right provider for you. No matter where you're at in the psychedelic therapy journey, we're here to help. Simply click the link in the show description below to book a consult and get connected to a trusted provider today.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Passage Podcast. My name is Jimmy Nguyen. I am your host today. I'm really excited about this episode. I'm just going to hop right in because I realized that in this podcast, there's a lot of things that I speak about that I'm really not an expert about, you know, whether that's from psychology terms that can relate to psychedelic experiences, to scientific assumptions that I'm making on how psychedelics work. And so anytime that we can get an expert in the field to come onto the show, I welcome that and I get very, very excited about. And so today's episode covers a lot of really important questions that have been coming up in the mycology community, in the psychedelic community, but specifically around the psilocybin mushroom community. And this revolves around questions like, does strain matter? Why do strains matter in psychedelic experiences? What can we glean from how those different strains or mushroom varietals, what can we glean and learn, and how might that affect the psychedelic experience? And so I've always had my guesses on what's going on in this field. And as always, you know, on the podcast, we try to create dialogue where this information can not only be digestible to folks, but also actionable. So I'm very, very excited to welcome our guest here today. Dr. Felix Bly holds a PhD in microbiology is an expert in natural products, especially alkaloids. Felix holds a PhD in microbiology and is a world-leading expert in natural product discovery, especially fungal alkaloids. He was able to actually elucidate the biosynthesis of psilocybin, which made significant advancements in the understanding of the composition, pathways, enzymatic processes within psychedelic mushrooms. One of his more, you know, potent, for lack of a better word, discoveries was the co-occurrence of beta carbolines in psilocybin strains, which raises a whole conversation about, you know, possible entourage effect in psychedelics, which could actually alter the felt effects when folks are consuming mushrooms. Following his PhD, Felix developed the first quantitative rapid test called Q-test. This means that you can actually quantify the amount of psilocybin in a sample. And then he expanded that Q-test system for other drugs like LSD, MDMA, and the like. After that, he founded a company called Miraculix, which is a spinoff from his university research which further tested these procedures and made these kits available to the public. From there, in cooperation with an addiction support organization in Thuringia, I hope I'm saying that right, in Germany, he developed the first state-run integrative mobile drug checking service called the Live, which he has successfully managed for 4 years as its scientific director. So you can tell that Felix and I have a lot of overlap in our passion and interest in harm reduction, in drug testing and checking, and then also what we can use, informationally to provide a little bit more background and information to folks as they are, discovering psychedelics, particularly psilocybin mushrooms. So welcome, Felix. It's so great to have you here on the show.
Thank you for the invitation. I always really like to talk about mushrooms. So, and I feel really honored to be here as an expert. So thank you for having the chance to talk about this.
Yeah, you're welcome. And really what we'll be doing here over the next little bit of time is really just getting two nerds in the room to talk about psilocybin. So I'm really excited to have you here. And to frame this up for our audience, I think what we'll be talking about today is a little bit of the scientific background and the study of Dr. Bly's work, how that relates to just the everyday experience of individuals, engaging in psilocybin mushrooms, and then what that means as far as their experience. And so, I'll first just start by saying that you as you've heard me talk on this episode or on this podcast before, is that due to the general lack of research around psychedelics in the United States over the past 50, 60 years, we're actually pretty limited in our knowledge on how these psychedelics work. And so there are other, countries, Germany being, one of them, that have been on the cutting edge of this study and this research. And so what I'll be doing today is serving my best in the role of the layman or the novice, and trying to almost like interpret some of this like technical conversation in a way that might, make sense for folks. And I think the first like distinction that I will draw is, though they're very, very different substances, I use the parallel of like cannabis a lot when I'm trying to think about the exploration of, psilocybin, where like when we're looking at psilocybin mushrooms, most people are thinking about two things, psilocybin and psilocin. And then, that might equate in cannabis to delta-8 tetrahydrocannabinol or THC. Most people are like, THC is the main thing that gets you high when you smoke cannabis. And then what they found over research was that there's way more cannabinoids than that. There's cannabidiol, CBD, which a lot of people understand has a lot of pain relieving and therapeutic effect in the absence of eliciting an actual like high effect. There's other things like CBN, which has been, shown to be helpful for sleep. There's CBG. They're showing that different, exposures to light can actually transform some of these cannabinoids to others. And so it blew everybody's mind to realize, oh, wait, there's way more than delta-8, THC in cannabis. And then after that, they discovered that there were terpenes that were also affecting and potentially modulating the high of cannabis. And so I really invite our listeners to dive into this world, with us. And Felix, I'm so excited to pick your brain today. And I would maybe ask for you to just start by possibly, if you're open to it, just giving like a general like primer to folks around psilocybin mushrooms, the main constituents that you're seeing, and just anything that you can share that just like sets a good base for this conversation for us today.
Maybe you would like to hear what I actually did in my PhD.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Mm-hmm. My PhD topic was really about biosynthesis of psilocybin. And together with my colleagues, I discovered for the first time in the world, actually the cluster, so the genes, which were responsible for the whole biosynthesis of this molecule. Until our research paper, the latest knowledge was mostly von Albert Hofmann, made in the 60s, with a totally wrong biosynthesis. So everyone thought it goes over DMT. And what we did, after we found the cluster, we used these enzymes, put them in other organisms, and tried to figure out the route. So how especially the psilocybin is made, in which steps. And after the end, so it's not only psilocybin, as you already told, there's a lot of precursors to that, which already in these mushrooms. And the common precursors to psilocybin are norbiocystin and beocystin. These are the ones which just have a metal group or two metal group less. And so we were able to really see how these mushrooms produce psilocybin on a molecular level. And for this, I also grow these mushrooms a lot in the lab. Maybe to give a short a background to that, we were really happy in the university to be allowed to grow these mushrooms. So in Germany, they are also illegal, like in the States. But we got a special agreement on that to handle these mushrooms. So I grow them in the lab under standardized conditions. And then we analyzed them as well with instrumental analyzers. This was just possible because we got the permission to work with these substances. And that's also the reason why nothing happened the last 50 years, as you said, because it was just also forbidden for researchers to work with these mushrooms in the lab. My professor is really like the expert in basiomycetes, so mushrooms you can eat. Mm. And so it was totally logic that he will also look into magic mushrooms in the hallucinogenic ones, because this is also a basiomycetes and he is a natural product expert. So this was, from a logical point, the reason why we got the permission to work on this substance. And over the years, I got a really good feeling about these mushrooms and actually how big the fluctuation even in the psilocybin is. And this was the reason I developed the quantitative test at the end. But also a really interesting discovery was the beta-carbolines. So at the end of my PhD, I even extended my PhD for researching a totally whole other class of natural substances in these mushrooms. You already touched on that. They are called beta-carbolines. And this is totally the same like in cannabis, where you not only have one molecule inside, it's more a full spectrum. That's the word for it. So a whole lot of molecules, which could play a role in the felt effects. And with cannabis, it took, I would say, 20 years to get a scientific word for that. It's called entourage effect. But actually, anecdotal stories from people who already consumed it since 20 years before, people already note that there's more than THC. Mm-hmm. And we're getting a lot of anecdotal stories from magic mushrooms as well in this kind of direction. So that people report truffles totally act different than psilocybin cubensis, or even different cubensis strains act different. Mm-hmm. This could be actually true because of all the different molecules which are in these mushrooms. And we really just started to learn about more, and there's so much more to discover inside these mushrooms.
Yeah, I've been sharing that almost as a hunch for quite some time, that my belief is that there's a lot more, you know, than meets the eye as it relates to the you know, hallucinogenic experience. And I've been sharing with folks that likely there's way more in the plant or fungi profile than just psilocybin and psilocin. And I love what you were saying, where, you know, magic mushrooms also happens to be mushrooms that we eat, though we just choose to eat them for a way different reason than, you know, culinary mushrooms or functional mushrooms. And I actually think that that's amazing that that was the pathway for your university to be able to engage, you know, in this type of research. And to give a little bit of a background to folks, Albert Hofmann was a scientist, psychedelic pioneer in kind of like Western society. And he was the first person to synthesize LSD from a fungus called ergot. And from there, then, you know, there was a lot of inquiry into psychedelic studies, but that mostly got halted in the late 60s, maybe early 70s, when a lot of these substances ended up on federally scheduled lists and things like that. And so, you know, what we're attempting to do here is draw some parallels and inferences from other plant and fungi medicines in the application of this conversation. What I'm hearing from you is that there are some precursors to psilocybin, which actually is pretty fascinating. And a lot of your research in university was around maybe where that originates. Can you replicate that in other organisms and species in that same effect? And then in that discovery, you had discovered an alkaloid, beta-carboline, which is generally present in some other, you know, psychedelic substances, namely dimethyltryptamine or DMT. So I find that super fascinating because I think that there's a lot of conversation around, you know, how similar or different are all of these different psychedelic substances. I mean, obviously today we're going to focus a little bit on, mostly on psilocybin strains, why that matters, if that matters, and, you know, anything that we can draw from there. But there has always been a conversation in the psychedelic community for me about how similar molecularly psilocybin cubensis might be to, let's say, DMT, right? There's something called a 4-ACO-DMT, which is somewhat almost like a sister compound to what we see in magic mushrooms. And then, so I wonder, can you like break that down a little bit for folks on like a molecular level of like a little bit of what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, this is like three questions in one. I tried
sure.
to answer.
You can tell how excited I am to pick your brain, so.
No worries. So yeah, let's start with the first one. So yeah, with the enzymes we put in other organisms, we actually were able to make an in vitro, and my colleagues also an in vivo biosynthesis. So we actually made a magic yeast, for example, or I made an approach where you could just put all the enzymes in one reaction tube, and after 2 hours, you have psilocybin out of tryptophan in just on the lab bench. So, and this is really good for GMP manufacturing, so more for the medical approach. But then I found these beta-carbolines, and the beta-carbolines are a whole class of natural products. You all might know them from the brew called ayahuasca, where beta-carbolines, especially the harmane, is out of Banisteriopsis carpii, so a tropical liane, and together mixed with, for example, Psychotria viridis. And this is a plant called, which contains a lot of DMT, like a tryptamine. And the point is the DMT acts on itself for sure. But if you mix this with the beta-carbolines together, it acts much longer and much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
This is because these beta-carbolines inhibit the degradation of the tryptamine in your body. So the DMT can act longer in your system. That's the mm-hmm. whole. That's the whole point. And so it was really interesting for me to get an end of the PhD to get the hint of, or there could be maybe better carbolines inside. So that's I first saw like a mass sign. Then I did some thin layer chromatography, and the good thing is they are fluorescent, so you can see them even small amounts. Lighting a lot on a thin plate where you load this in the lab. And so step by step, I went to my professor, told him this. I made more experiments, which really proved at the end that these mushrooms producing these beta carbolions, and this is not an artifact or something. And we published this out of different psilocybin strains. But my biggest problem was that I only could analyze or purify the beta carbolions out of strains I could grow in the lab. And so I was limited more on cubensis and the truffles. And I also had samples from wild psilocybin strains like cyanescans, where I saw much more beta carbolines already. So this is really just the start. So my personal guess would be, based on my experiments, that in the wild strains or species, there are even plenty more of these beta carbolines. So there seems to be a huge diversity, but they are also just in a small amount present. Now, this raises the question. As we now know, the beta carbolines could inhibit the degradation or slow the degradation of psilocybin. Could this have an effect on maybe how fast this acts, or how long, or make this your felt effects stronger? At least on a pharmaceutical point, you know, these two act together, and the action is called synergistic. There are not a lot of stories in nature where this synergistic stuff is found naturally. So keep in mind, the ayahuasca, this is something you did yourself, like you put the two plants together. So it's really interesting that these mushrooms make both at the same time. This would make a lot of sense if your main active metabolite is psilocybin, and then throw in another class, which even make the first metabolite much stronger. So this makes a lot of sense from a pharmaceutical point, but there's actually no studies on what this means in a real world. So this is just now guesses, but it's already a really good hint on that.
Wow, that's fat. Let me pause for a second to not only break that down a little bit for myself, but also, you know, for the audience. You're speaking about a couple of things. First and foremost is this what they call like an entourage effect, which I think is just a modern term for synergy, a synergistic effect, in that different constituents, let's say in plants or fungi, when they come into interaction together, that they are more than the sum of their parts. They elicit some type of either an effect or some type of feature when these components come together. Now, when you're talking about ayahuasca, you know, which there are different traditions that brew ayahuasca, you know, differently. There's also, you know, yahe and, you know, kind of different constituents, but that generally is just keep it simple for folks, is a combination of a vine and a leaf. The vine being, you know, what you're discovering to have these natural beta carbolines, particularly, I believe it's harmine and one other one I'm kind of forgetting. And when that combines with the naturally occurring DMT, then that is something that humans are choosing to combine so that the reuptake of the serotonin that kicks off in the DMT experience can generally last longer and be more potent. This is where we talk about the introduction of like MAOIs, which are monoamine oxidase inhibitors. You know, folks generally like look at that from a medical perspective, thinking about their medications and if there are any like medical contraindications, which, you know, something like that could lead to things like, you know, serotonin syndrome. But to translate that over to psilocybin mushrooms, what I hear you saying is that instead of humans making that connection, brewing two different plants together, in psilocybin mushrooms, like nature is doing that by having the presence of these beta carbolines and how that interacts with the psilocybin part of it. Am I getting that right?
You're getting the totally right, and that's the interesting point. There are not many examples in nature where you have a synergistic action. Another story would be to make an antibiotic, but also something which inhibits the resistance to an antibiotic. This is another example where you make your first molecule much stronger or more effective with a second one. I try to not use all the nerd terms here,
I love it. Use as many nerd terms as you want, and I will do my best to translate, you know, to folks.
So yeah, and then just take the example of you have like an antibiotic, and then you have these beta lactam suppressors, so which just can, let's say, digest the antibiotic, and then mushrooms tend to produce also something which just inhibits the resistance to their own antibiotic, which makes the antibiotic much more effective. And this is just another rare example of a mushroom doing two things, producing two molecules, two metabolites, which both act totally different on different places, but their action is meant for a goal which both have in common. And this, for me, raises the question more and more, what is actually the goal for psilocybin production? Mm-hmm. This is also something we looked into that in the lab a lot, and not only we, also a lot of other people in the world, and we actually have not a really strong hypothesis here on place. Why mushrooms? So I love to talk about this.
I question this all the time, and I want to get your input, because you asked a very important question, like, what is actually the goal of psilocybin, you know, mushrooms? And obviously we're speaking from a, you know, a scientific standpoint, but I question this all the time from a spiritual standpoint and from like a psychonaut standpoint. I actually just, you know, was speaking on a past episode about like animism as it relates to psychedelic work, which is like the belief that there's like an inherent intelligence or a knowledge within all of these different plant and fungi teachers. So I know you're saying there's not a really good hypothesis, but if you could take a guess, what do you think the goal is, you know, with all of this?
I can just tell from a really recent research. So actually there were two papers outside which looked in a bioinformatic way on how old these psilocybin clusters. And it was really surprising. One paper stated this, let's say, 2 million billion years ago. Mm. And the other one, I think, 50. And so what I want to say with that, this is a long time for the humans developed on Earth, and even before primates were on Earth. It's more like when snails and termites,
crustaceans, and to put that into perspective for folks, this is also very affirming to me, because I've been saying this for a long time without any scientific backing on it. So thank you. Where I would say that, you know, psilocybin mushrooms have likely been around for millions of years, whereas humans, like modern day humans, have really been around from anywhere like 150 to 300,000 years. Mm-hmm. And then I found it fascinating that our human biology can have a gastrointestinal system that has the ability to break down psilocybin mushrooms in a way for us to have a hallucinogenic effect. And I just find that fascinating.
And my point was with that definitely we can say it, that humans are not the reason for the occurrence of psilocybin, because it was there much more before. And we could also not see that there's a bigger spread after humans developed on Earth. These mushrooms were there before. So my common, the common hypotheses are more like, so an interesting fun fact, again, is the blue color. If you press a magic mushrooms, mm-hmm. most of them are really fastly stained blue, strongly.
Right,
blue.
There's like a bruising effect. Like if you break a stem or something, or even press on it, you'll see that it actually turns blue in color.
And this is an enzymatic process, and the blue color is made out of psilocybin. So there are two enzymes, one which dephosphorylates psilocybin, and another one which, let's say, connects different psilocins together to a chain, and this chain, this polymer, makes the blue color. This is an fast thing, so it takes 1 to 2 minutes, and then there's the blue color. And so your psilocybin gonna be degraded for that, so it's gone. A blue color. It's a polymer. It's really, I think most of the scientists think that's not active anymore because it cannot pass the blood-brain barrier as this polymer. And so there's the question in the room that the mushrooms just make this compound for making the blue color, as for example, a strategy against snail which eats you, or some other hurtings of the mushroom as a defense mechanism.
So it's reactive to the environment is what I hear you saying. So like by nature of psilocybin containing mushrooms having this bruising effect, if there was a species, cough, cough, the human species, who was, let's say, cultivating or curating these things, then what I hear you saying is that the handling and the care of, you know, cultivating mushrooms actually impacts the quantitative amount of psilocybin in there. Because if you are roughing it up and you have this polymer effect, then you're basically going to be degrading the psilocybin that's contained in there, if I'm hearing you right.
Totally. The key fact is moisture here. So these enzymes I was talking about, they need water to work. So the key fact is to always dry your mushrooms correctly, and then these enzymes cannot work anymore. And the psilocybin is a really stable molecule. And this is the reason why the mushrooms really try to keep all psilocybin, because this is the one which cannot degrade easily. The psilocin is the one which, yeah, like I said, polymerizes really fast.
Mm. Do you have any sense on like shelf life or stability of psilocybin? You're saying that psilocybin is generally very stable. Like, is there's kind of a question out there on like shelf life and how long the, you know, potency of psilocybin can stay intact. Any thoughts on that?
Totally. There's also a paper on outside which states really short lifetime. And in contrast to that, I totally got other results in my university lab. And I can bring an example. I have like mushrooms. I would say they are 5 or 6 years old. I collected outside and just stored in the lab. And they have roughly half of the potency left.
You said half?
Half, yeah.
After half. 5 or 6 years.
Yes. So I guess that's it's good.
You would imagine that there would be zero, and I would also venture to say that like shelf life, I would guess, is impacted by these other alkaloids and constituents in there as well. Because if you're saying that, for example, if you're saying that psilocybin has other psilocybin containing mushrooms has other constituents in there, you were drawing this example that not only does it have the main active ingredient, but also a vehicle or a carrier with it that makes it more, let's say, bioavailable, which can also affect duration and potency, then it would be easy for me, kind of a dude off the street, to say, oh, well, it would make sense then for psilocybin to also have things that also preserve the psilocybin mushroom almost as like a protectorant over time, would be my guess.
The psilocybin is really already I always compare it with like a hand grenade. So psilocybin is the hand grenade. And if you put the splinter away, that's the psilocin. It then polymerizes really quickly. So the psilocybin is really the storage form. I think on a chemical point, you can heat it up until 200 degrees. The enemy is, like I said, water. If you store this not right, there's an oxidation or these enzymatic degradation, and that's more like your enemy. If you store it in really coldly frozen, freeze-dried, I would guess you have even less potency loss. And if you store psilocybin as a pure molecule, this is also a really stable compound. There are samples, I think, from Albert Hofmann time, which are still showed a lot of psilocybin inside. They were just recently used in some research studies to show the crystal structure he made.
Mm. And were you talking about 200 degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Oh, the Celsius, actually.
Oh, so, wow. Okay, so there has a really high threshold for heat is what I'm hearing.
This explains why people can make a hot soup out of it.
Or a tea or something like that.
Yeah, a tea.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Maybe the last thing is the publication about terpenes, because mm-hmm. you already touched this. This is a publication also from my working group in university, from my colleagues, and they just found different terpenes which were naturally occurring in these psilocybin mushrooms. They all have really funny names, and this raises much more the question now, We have these precursors, we have beta-carbolines, and we also have terpenes in these mushrooms. And we are sure that there's effect on psilocybin as there's an effect on just THC. But what is the effect of the others? How is this modulating? And people are responding these effects similar to cannabis, where the term of the entourage effect was made. This is a term made out of cannabis, actually.
Wow, fascinating. Okay, let me draw a couple of points of connection for folks. So, like, let's say you had two different oranges, and one orange smelled a little bit more sweet, and another orange smelled a little bit more sour. Terpenes being the constituent that's responsible for smell and how we receive in our olfactory system. Also, we are more attracted to certain smells than others. Depending on our human preferences and biology, some folks would really be attracted to a smell. A very different person could smell the same thing and be like, that's absolutely disgusting. Now, the interesting parallel here is that if you ate both of those oranges, you would expect that the content of vitamin C in each one is the content of vitamin C, regardless of which, if one smelled more sweet or one smelled more sour, right? Like, the nutrients in the food is the nutrients in the food. Then you translate over to cannabis and they say, wait, actually, depending on the makeup and profile of the terpenes, that's actually what's modulating your high more than this misnomer of sativa, indica, or ruderalis. It's actually the presence of terpenes that actually make you feel more energized or more sleepy, or a cannabis strain that might relieve more chronic pain, or a cannabis strain that might increase appetite. So there's this really interesting world of discovery when people were like, wait, terpenes are actually the driver of the anecdotal experience that people are feeling. Now you're saying that you're discovering that there are terpenes in psilocybin-containing mushrooms, which I find fascinating.
Yes, and likely to cannabis, we are just starting this research. So there's a bunch of them we found, and now is the question, which influence they might have? Is it just for maybe attracting insects or repelling insects? There could be so many influences on terpenes, like you said. But just the case that there are terpenes inside, it's so interesting and raises much more the question of these, like you said, totally different felt effects of cannabis. I find this also really interesting. If you put two strains with just like 20% THC and a totally different mix, a totally different full spectrum, that this can have a totally uplifting effect or a sedative effect. And I would say if you compare these effects together, some of them would even not be known as cannabis effects. Like if you think in a more psychedelic direction. And so that's totally awesome that just the minor alkaloids influence the 20% THC this much with modulating receptors, making modulating binding affinities. And even in cannabis, we are just in the beginning of understanding of the entourage effect. And there are some more, there are these riboflavins, mm-hmm. and so many more players in the game. And I guess in the psychoactive mushrooms world, this will be the same. And at least this is my hypothesis, that we are just starting to discover what other stuff is inside, which could play a role in the felt effects. But also, and this is my question, would this also be differed than in the therapeutic usage? So for example, if you have strains which are more colorful with a more visual trip, or strains which have a more mindful and more body perception.
Sure. So that wraps it up here for us on this part one episode with Dr. Felix Bly. Thanks for joining us here, and we look forward to connecting with you next week when we break down even further about Dr. Bly's research and all things scientific related to psilocybin mushrooms. Before we go, I'll read a quick review from our community. This one is about a consult call that came through. It said the consultant was very thorough and knowledgeable. It made it very clear that the organization is a referral service, so expectation would be realistic. Thanks to that community member who sent forward that piece of feedback. And really great to have you all here listening to this episode. You can find episodes of our podcast anywhere you find podcasts, primarily Apple and Spotify. Check us out on YouTube, Instagram, and Reddit as well. And join us next week as we wrap up the part two episode with Dr. Felix Bly of Q-Test and Miraculix. Thanks so much. I am excited to share a new offering that can be found on our website, psychedelicpassage.com, which is our digital store. We here at Psychedelic Passage are constantly thinking about ways to enrich the intentional psychedelic process for our community. And now with this digital store, you'll be able to find preparation guides, integration guides, and recorded workshops that are typically only available to our clients. We hope that this is an exciting offering, and we look forward to adding more content over time. So check out the link in the episode description below or visit our website, psychedelicpassage.com. And we are very excited to expand our service offerings to the greater community.